You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jen Zaman, sitting in for the absent Judy Ansel. And tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers 53. United Auto Workers Local 249 members build the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. IBEW Local 53 represents construction linemen, electric, gas, and water utility workers, broadcast engineers at TV stations, line clearance workers, linemen for rural electric cooperatives, employees at rural electric generating stations, and anyone else who is interested. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. Welcome to tonight's show. Tonight, does the World Bank work for working people? Not according to a new study about how poor people are chased off their land to make way for shiny new projects. And on Pioneer Women, Susan Sanders interviews a woman welder. In the news, we've got an important part of Canadian labor history is losing its place in a Winnipeg museum. We have news out of Qatar, and we have news out of Honduras. So here is the news.
The news from our side, May 28th. 2015. The World Soccer Organization, FIFA, has been in the news this week following an embarrassing scandal involving their top leaders. But another embarrassing scandal FIFA has been neglecting to address is the treatment of foreign workers who are building the stadiums for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Qatar has reportedly refused to grant bereavement leave to roughly 400,000 immigrant workers from Nepal building stadiums for the World Cup following a devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 8,000 countrymen. As a result, many Nepalese workers instead must mourn from the construction sites in Qatar. On Saturday, The Guardian reported that Nepalese government called on FIFA and its sponsors to compel Qatar to grant a short-term leave for Nepalese immigrant workers to improve conditions for the 1.5 million workers from throughout South Asia. But the Persian Gulf state rebuffed that request. Nepalese Labor Minister Tiak Bukara told Guardian, "Those on the World Cup construction site are not being allowed to leave because of the pressure to complete the projects on time." A 2013 report from The Guardian estimated up to 4,000 South Asian workers could lose their lives to unsafe working environments and difficult living conditions in Qatar in the run-up to the 2022 World Cup. Qatar claims they have no choice but to import laborers in because to complete the estimated $220 billion worth of construction they have planned for the next 7 years. So far, FIFA has stood their decision to allow Qatar to host the event.
This week, a delegation from Kansas City is in Honduras to learn more about the economic and political conditions there and to help students and workers organizing for their rights. While in Honduras, they have learned more about the factory conditions for workers there and are sharing the stories they have heard via social media. On May 27th, the delegation met with a group called Centro de Derechos de Mujeres, or the Center for Women's Rights. CDM has trained almost 500 women in basic labor law, so they know how to assert themselves in their workplaces. In addition to training advocates, they also file claims against employers who violate labor laws. At the moment, they have 785 individual cases and 120 collective cases going through the court system in Honduras. The violations include poor working conditions and limited breaks. In one instance, workers were forced to wear diapers because they were not permitted to go to the bathroom during their shifts. The delegation returns from Honduras next week, and we will share more information about what they learned on their trip in the near future.
The AFSCME wants to help older union members make some quick bucks while helping hipsters keep up with the season's latest looks. In a blog post from May 20th, the AFSCME writes, "Do you have a pair of old AFSCME t-shirts in the back of your closet? It turns out there's a market for those. We noticed one shirt for sale in a trendy vintage shop on Etsy.com, where it sold for $15. There are old AFSCME jackets going for sale for as much as $100 on eBay. The union movement is getting a lot of renewed attention these days, and not just because we're fighting back against unprecedented assaults on working people. There's something retro cool about the labor movement. Young people show strong support for unions. And for those who might want to join a union, we can promise a whole lot more than vintage t-shirts. So, if you have any old union t-shirts or hats that you are looking to clear out, don't just put them with the rest of your shirts at the garage sale. Put them up on Craigslist and enjoy a trip to the Royals game or a night at the movies while helping hipsters look their union best this summer." Speaking of hipsters and unions, the highly trafficked online news site Gawker is voting next week on whether they will join the Writers Guild of America East. They have decided to publish a staff discussion on their website, where writers for the website are sharing their feelings about organizing and talking about how they plan to vote. Here's what Gawker writer Madeline Davies had to say. "The fact of the matter is that Gawker Media is not our friend. The chief executive might be our friend, the managers might be our friends, but Gawker Media, though a positive influence in our lives, is not. The company has a team of highly capable lawyers to protect it from legal threats. Legal threats that could one day include a mistreated colleague. Joining the Writers Guild of America would grant us our own legal protection if and when something ever goes wrong. The union is a safety net. Things are good now. I am voting yes because I think the WGA can help us keep it that way." In addition to a space for the writers to discuss how they plan to vote, there is another comment section where anyone can contribute. We encourage you to go over to their website and tell the writers you support their decision to vote in favor of organizing a union.
An important part of Canadian labor history is losing its place in a Winnipeg museum, and local labor organizers are none too pleased with the situation. Mia Rabson had the story for the Winnipeg Free Press. A Winnipeg general strike exhibit at the Canadian Museum of Civilization is not being singled out for elimination, the facility spokeswoman said Monday. Chantal Schreier, Vice President of Corporate Affairs at the museum, said that all of the modules that make up the Canada Hall, including the Winnipeg General Strike vignette, have been torn down as the gallery is remade into the Canadian History Hall, set to open on Canada's 150th birthday on July 1, 2017. "Everything is gone," said Schreier. "We are starting from a fresh new plate. It will not be the same at all." But Manitoba NDP MP Pat Martin, who provided the original photograph of the meeting room at the James Street Labor Temple that was used to recreate the room in the museum, said he doesn't believe this is not the government at work trying to stamp out labor history. "This is damage control," Martin said. "I don't buy it. They are trying to sanitize Canadian history." Critics have accused the government of trying to rewrite Canadian history ever since the government announced in 2012 the Canadian Museum of Civilization was going to be rebranded the Canadian Museum of History and overhauled as a part of the birthday celebrations. The government suddenly denied that suggestion. If you are looking to see some labor history exhibits around Kansas City, it might be worth it to check out the National Archives of Kansas City, their new exhibit titled All Sewn Up, The Garment Industry Goes to Court. According to the website for the show, the cases in the museum chronicle significant events in the history of the labor movement and the rise of unions in the garment industry. The museum is up the street from Union Station and is open to the public Tuesdays until Saturdays. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoir, Maria Vasquez Boyd, Jake White, and I am Jen Zaman.
dusty roads and hold those with souls that only God knows. Only those trolls can behold these woes that break backs and wear souls and not be froze. I plot each roll with the seeds for the crops we sow. Break bread but turn ghosts when we clock the pole. Even though we got papers, they not for show. So we come and go like the peoples who came before. Years from spinning flax and picking indigo and scratching out the living on the edge of a land that stole. Minute man hem the border to stem the flow. But the blood and sweat watered all that they bought it to stole. Cash for crops from tobacco to hops. From the fields of Carolina to the northwest docks. From the foot of the Rockies and its snow-capped tops. Down to the Grand Canyon and its windswept rocks. We stock wheat to corn, illegal and hated on. The people whose labor wrong, so many depend upon. On the edge of the cities, you can see us and then. We come with the dust and we're going with the wind. On the edge of the cities, you can see us and then. We come with the dust, but we're going with the wind. When on the edge of the cities, you can see us and then. We come with the dust and we're gone, gone. Up and gone at dawn to find work by the street corner, auction block where crime lurks. The line jerks as gringos grind time and the dimes, taking the fruit of our labor, leaving us with the rhymes.
The social scientist Anna Singh describes post-World War II notions of globalization as emerging from, quote, the sense not only that all men are brothers, but that we are common custodians of a single fragile planet, an idea encapsulated by photographs of the Earth taken from outer space by astronauts in the 1960s. I'm Jacob White for the Heartland Labor Forum. Social scientists who are critical of global bureaucratic institutions such as the World Bank assert that these organizations have failed since gaining power in the 80s and 90s to live up to the ideals that emerged from the 60s. One of the primary criticisms of academics and activists who studied these phenomena is that while globalization was meant to encourage a more, quote, borderless world, people remain largely stuck in whatever country they were born in, while financial institutions are capable of operating wherever they like, often in a manner insensitive to the needs of the people living in the way of their massive development projects. In the late 1990s, activists, unions, and NGOs organized major protests against the activities of the World Bank and other global trade institutions, such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization. These actions scaled back dramatically in the early years of the Bush administration, as unions and NGOs decided it was an inappropriate time to criticize the actions of bureaucrats and bankers in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Nonetheless, the World Bank has tried to account for some of the issues brought to the public's attention by the protests in the late Clinton era. Sasha Chavkin is a reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He has previously written for ProPublica, Columbia Journalism Review, and The New York World, an investigative website covering New York. He was also the lead reporter for ICIJ and Center for Public Integrity's award-winning Island of the Widows and Mystery in the Fields projects, which examined a mysterious form of kidney disease that is killing agricultural workers across continents. He joins us today to discuss a major new project he has been working on, Evicted and Abandoned, the World Bank's Broken Promise to the Poor, which can be accessed on ICIJ's website, icij.org. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, Sasha.
Thanks, Jake. It's good to be with you.
Thanks. According to your article, in an internal survey conducted last year by bank auditors, 77% of employees responsible for enforcing the institution's safeguards said they think that management does not value their work. What is the main obstacle internal World Bank auditors face, and why are they not taken seriously?
Well, I think this goes to two somewhat conflicting identities that are at the heart of the World Bank. On the one hand, the bank is this idealistic organization with a mission of eradicating extreme poverty. And on the other hand, it's a bank. And as a bank, it makes money by giving out loans and receiving interest on those loans. So the bank has bottom line pressure to make sure that it's sending money out the door and approving loans. What we found in our investigation is that some current and former staffers described a culture of the bank where the emphasis was on getting loan approved on getting loans approved and getting money out the door, sometimes at the expense of enforcing the safeguards for the environment and for local populations that the bank has in place.
So when it comes to the local populations and, you know, a lot of times we're talking about rural people, and some conservative economists who are, you know, support big cities say that it's good when people, you know, have to move to the city, whether it's for economic or environmental reasons, because in cities there's more opportunity. And so it's kind of an excuse for displacing people, but do you think anyone at the World Bank would admit that this is a benefit? And what is the World Bank's philosophy regarding this point? Has it changed in the course of the bank's history?
So first, I'd like to step back and say a little bit about what our investigation found.
Sure.
What we found is that over the last decade, projects that are funded by the World Bank physically or economically displaced 3.4 million people, meaning that those people were either forced from their homes, lost some of their land, or had their livelihoods damaged. At the same time as this large-scale displacement was occurring, the bank was failing regularly to apply its own policies for protecting the people who were in the path of its projects, and specifically for resettling those people in equal or better conditions than they had been living in before the World Bank's projects. Now, to get to your question about the advantages or disadvantages of displacement, I don't think anyone is arguing that you should never displace people. Pretty much every country has some version of an eminent domain law that allows authorities to move certain populations in the name of economic development. But what the real question is if you follow a legal process and you respect people's rights when displacement occurs. What we found is that people were often being woken up in the morning by police or soldiers or private security guards who burned people's houses down, who violently removed them, who didn't follow any kind of legal process in removing people from lands that were then being used for development.
And we're talking about very large development projects in a lot of these cases. Could you maybe take us through a case?
Sure. So one of the examples that we looked at was a case in Lagos, Nigeria. That's a megacity of something like 18 million people living there. The World Bank funded an urban renewal project that was supposed to be revitalizing slum neighborhoods in Lagos. What ended up happening in a community called Badi East is that more than 9,000 people were forcibly evicted one morning without notice, without compensation, or without any warning about what was going to happen. Literally, the police poured into the streets. They were banging their batons on the ground and on people's shanties. Bulldozers came in shortly after, and within a matter of hours, flattened this neighborhood. The community then filed a complaint to the World Bank and received some partial compensation from Lagos authorities. But what we found is that the World Bank ended up approving an agreement that did not meet its own standard of restoring people to equal or better living conditions. The Lagos authorities paid the people who were evicted as much as 31% less than the original value of their home, and they didn't resettle anyone who was driven from their homes in the eviction.
So a big part of this arrangement is that the people who are displaced are supposed to get equal value to what they're losing?
Right. What the policy says is that if you are displaced in the name of development by a World Bank project, then you will be restored to equal or better living conditions, which can mean compensation, but even more than that, it's supposed to mean you get a house that is on equally good land, that you get a job that restores you to an equally good livelihood. You know, these aren't things that can be guaranteed overnight, but the pledge that the World Bank makes if they finance someone's displacement, they will also finance their resettlement and the restoration of their livelihood.
And traditionally, you know, we spoke a little earlier about how the bank has, you know, conflicting ideals between being a lender and supposed to alleviate extreme poverty. So the World Bank's more recent leader, Jim Yong Kim, it was considered important that he was selected. He was kind of different from past leaders. Can you talk about why and how he's been performing so far?
Yeah, it was really perceived as this huge breath of fresh air when Jim Yong Kim was chosen as the World Bank's president. He's a physician who's best known for humanitarian work in Haiti and in Africa, fighting malaria and HIV/AIDS. He was the first World Bank president who wasn't a politician or a banker or financier before assuming the office. And he actually, about two decades ago, participated in protests outside the World Bank calling for the bank to be shut down. So among NGOs and watchdogs and people who, you know, are calling on the bank to pay more attention to vulnerable populations, his appointment was seen as a very hopeful step. Now, what's actually happened in the nearly 3 years that he's been in office now is that he's expressed a lot of concern about safeguards and affected populations. But what's actually happening is that under his watch, the World Bank is rewriting its social and environmental safeguards in a way that's expected to set a new standard for the next generation of bank projects. And a lot of observers, including experts from the United Nations, and in fact the United States Congress itself, in a measure that it passed in last year's budget, have felt that the new safeguards that President Kim and his team have proposed would be a substantial setback from the rules that are in place right now.
Does that include labor issues?
Labor is an issue that's involved in the safeguards. The safeguards are a set of policies that address the impact of World Bank-funded development projects on the people and environment around them. So it's labor rights, the environment, involuntary resettlement, which is what we looked at, mm-hmm. Disability, discrimination, the type of due diligence that the World Bank has to do before approving projects. These are the type of policies that are involved in the safeguards. The World Bank has long been seen as a pioneer in international development for having a stronger set of safeguards policies than other institutions like regional development banks or private lenders. But what we found in our investigation is that while they have these high standards on paper, in many cases, they're not really enforcing them.
So these regional development banks or, you know, Chinese development banks or private banks, they also have issues with displacing people during development projects.
Yes, that's correct. Pretty much everywhere you have development, you have some form of displacement.
Mm-hmm. And so, what can we expect, though, from competition between them and the World Bank? Is that only gonna make, you know, labor and environmental issues a lower priority?
That's certainly what the concern is. The positive side of having all these other development banks is that there's more money to fund development and more sources of money to fund development. And I think everyone's in agreement that there's an urgent need for health programs and affordable housing and infrastructure and all the things that the poorest countries in the world are lacking. At the same time, the social and environmental standards that the World Bank has, even if it often doesn't follow them, may be significantly rolled back. And the overall global standards for protecting human rights and poor people who are affected by development might decline. So the fear is essentially that the competition from these regional and China-based development banks will push the World Bank away from the standard that it's upheld over the last several decades.
Okay. And how has World Bank responded to your reporting? And what outcomes do you hope to achieve with this project, both in terms of the journalistic style and in drawing attention to problems within the World Bank?
So we've had some interesting interactions with the World Bank. We spent months going back and forth with them over the data analysis we did of the records, asking them to explain their policies and why their own records showed there was such a lack of compliance with their own rules. On March 4th, after months of discussions we'd had with the bank, and 5 days after we sent the bank detailed questions in which we laid out our findings, Jim Yong Kim, the president of the World Bank, announced a resettlement action plan, which he said was intended to fix the deep flaws that he'd identified in the World Bank's resettlement policy. And at the same time, as he said this, the World Bank released 3 internal reports, which had not been made public, and 2 of which had not been known to us, which essentially showed that for years the World Bank had known that it was failing to comply with its own resettlement policies. For the resettlement action plan, the World Bank says it's now going to spend more money on enforcing its safeguards, and it's going to improve its procedures and its monitoring of the safeguards to see that they're actually followed in the future. We're looking closely at how effective this plan is likely to be and whether the World Bank is following through on what it says. And actually, I'd encourage you to stay tuned for a story in the next few days about the World Bank's promises for reform and what's really going on there.
Great. And, okay, so one last question, and it's sort of a broader question, but other than the broad issue of economic globalization, is there anything from the history and present of the World Bank that we can use to understand the TPP deal that's currently in Congress right now?
Sure. It's not a direct connection, but one theme that I think is common is the emergence of China as an economic superpower and the shift of the global economy toward Asia. One of the big things that's happened in development right now is China has set up its own development bank, which is perceived by many as a competitor to the World Bank. In the last few months, the U.S.'s closest allies, so the U.K. and Germany and France, have joined the China Bank over the U.S.'s objections. And even the World Bank now, which is traditionally controlled by the United States, is now welcoming the China Bank, saying we look forward to working together on promoting development. Now, this is happening at the same time as you.
Hi there. I'm Valerie Andrus, president of KKFI's all-volunteer board of directors. You may have gotten a letter in the mail from me recently asking you for your support of KKFI, your community radio station. In my letter, I stress that KKFI is there for you and you only. I ask for your thoughts about how well we're meeting your needs. You listen to us, and we want to listen to you, because we exist only so long as you listen. When my letter arrives in your mailbox, please take a minute or two and share your thoughts with me. I promise your voice will be heard. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Good evening. This is Susan Sanders bringing you another episode of Pioneer Women here on Heartland Labor Forum. As you know, Pioneer Women is all about those women who tend to think outside the box and end up working in a job or workload that is typically done by a man. And tonight, we have a woman welder, Leslie Bufford. Oh. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Thank you, Susan. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Leslie, I understand that you grew up in a family of union members, and I'm just wondering, how in the world did you become a welder? I mean, are your family members welders?
No, actually, my great uncle was a welder back when they built the St. Louis Arch.
Oh.
And that I always did kind of like playing with fire when I was a kid. So I had a job in a factory where they taught me to weld at lunch, and that got the bug going about 7-8 years ago.
Really? So you were just playing around with equipment that could be dangerous.
Well, the thing was, where I worked, they were going to have some people retire.
Yeah.
In a couple of months. And then I was just talking with the guys at lunch, and it just happened to be that we were talking, and it was like they asked me if I wanted to learn to weld, and they taught me to MIG weld, and we were doing tractor-trailer landing gear.
Tractor-trailer landing gear. Now, how in the world does that work? Do tractor-trailers, they don't fly?
No.
What do they need landing gear for?
Landing gear is like when a truck driver drops a load off.
Yes.
It's those legs that come down in the front of the trailer to even it out so it doesn't get top heavy and fall over. It made them for like one of the companies was probably like Great Dane or some was the military.
I see. Well, so that's called MEG welding?
MIG.
MIG welding.
Yes.
And what is arc welding? Because I've heard of the two, I've heard that there are two types of welding.
Well, actually, there's MIG, TIG, and ARC.
Oh, my. Okay.
And there's a couple of different, and I'm not really proficient in all of them.
Yeah.
Especially like TIG, but I want to grow and get better within that.
Yeah.
With like doing like pipe and stuff like that, because I'm more structural.
Yes.
Than pipe, and I want to delve into it more and get better with it with over time.
So your great uncle happened to be a welder, and he was in a union.
Yes.
Okay. And so as you were telling me before we went on air that you had grown up in a family of union members.
Carpenters Union.
Carpenters Union.
Carpenters
okay.
Union and Hoisting Engineers, which is heavy equipment operators.
I see. And what can you tell our listeners about growing up in a family of union members? What's the plus of that?
Oh, wow. I have to say... the hardworking ethic, like with my sister and I, it was just like we would help, like when somebody in the family was building the house, we would help out and do like more or less like the laborer's type
yes.
job and that. And then, you know, like whether it was roofing, building the trusses before the roof was put on, or building the walls, etc.
So you were accustomed to just getting your hands in the mix of the dirt and just going for it. It didn't, the fact that you were a woman did not cause you to back away from the hard work.
No.
Not to say that women would avoid hard work, but this sounds like heavy work, requiring a lot of strength.
Not necessarily. It all depends on whether if you're doing something that's like a custom job, which is like somebody building a house, or like you're industrial, like building a something, say, like on the plaza or downtown.
Yeah.
Now, that might require like overhead cranes and different things like that, depending on what the building material is, whether it's wood
mm-hmm.
or metal.
Well, Leslie, when I look at you, I mean, you appear to be maybe in your 30s. And if someone saw you walking down the street, I'm sure they would never dream you were a woman welder. Does this affect your relationships with men?
No, actually, it doesn't. It kind of throws them off in the beginning.
Yeah.
But I am my own person, and it was like if they can't understand that, then, you know, I can, you know, I've got a lot of guy friends
mm-hmm.
that are in the construction industry and stuff like that, whether they're bricklayers, carpenters, etc.
Mm-hmm. How about your relationships with women? How do they accept you or feel when you tell them you're a welder?
Sometimes they think it's a little bit strange, but they're also a little bit of excited to know, mm-hmm. like with the questions you've asked so far, is like, how did you get interested mm-hmm. in everything? So it's kind of intriguing to see how different people react to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's been the most intriguing response you've gotten to anybody, from anybody, about your work as a welder?
It's been pretty much borderline between men and women in that, and I've grown up and I've gotten used to it over the years, because I've never had what has basically been factored in is like a female job. Yes. I've always worked around men and in factories and that, and then I want to get out of the factories, or what I would love to get into, a mm-hmm. union fabrication shop. Rather, it's the iron workers or like the boiler makers mm-hmm. in that. So
right now you're not in a union.
I have filled out the paperwork mm-hmm. and everything. And then like sometimes there are a few companies, they'll flat out, or like some superintendents.
Yes.
They'll say, well, we don't hire women. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that. I'm kind of like the wrong person to tell that to.
Yeah.
Considering how I grew up.
Yes.
And that, and actually one of my mom and dad's friends was a union representative for the Carpenters Union.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, that does not fly. Mm-hmm. And then actually when I learned to weld, I was actually in the Machinist Union.
I see.
Originally. And then I got laid off and never called back, mm-hmm. you know, and then they started shipping stuff overseas, so.
So now you're wanting to get back into a union, and you're not necessarily wanting to go into the Machinist Union, you're wanting to go into
like the iron workers, or more or less I would really love to get into like the boiler makers for like the different types of welding.
Yes.
And then they also, which is also really, really intriguing to me, is they also do like blacksmithing.
Oh, interesting.
In that it's,
you mean like for horses?
No. You see like wrought iron gates
yes.
in fencing and different things like that.
Right.
They get into more like the detail of that and like heating the metal, forming it and doing different applications, whether it's structural or something very artistic for somebody that they're wanting done.
So custom jobs or
yes.
wrought iron.
Yeah.
So you may be in high demand if you were in New Orleans.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
I like to keep a broad perspective on it because I like to do sculptural stuff like that and different things like that. So I just, the more I learn, the more I could put into my craft.
Well, Leslie, can you tell our listeners what has been your most interesting experience as a woman welder, and what has been your worst experience as a woman welder?
Well, so far, because I learned to weld at a place, actually SAF Holland, Binkley, a little place in the middle of Missouri. And then, you know, and it was the guys I worked with, because like at lunch when I would be practicing my welding, it ended up being sculptural stuff.
Yes.
And I'm sure some of those guys probably kept some of those pieces I made during lunch, because I would go dumpster diving for scraps to have stuff to weld on,
uh-huh.
because it was just like stuff that they would have scrapped out, or like pieces off of the shears and that. So that's mm-hmm. how I learned to weld. It was like on scraps and that. And they were always telling me, it was like, well, that looks kind of like a really cool birdhouse or something like that. So I'm sure they kept some of that as sculptural pieces.
So that was satisfying to you.
Yes.
What's the worst experience?
Going to some, I've been to like one or two job sites, and they have actually told me that they do not hire women. And I'm wondering, you know, what's really based on that, because I know that there's more than me out there in the Kansas City vicinity.
Yes.
That is a welder. We're not always stuck in the kitchen or in a factory, you know. I like to be hands-on and do my own thing, and the only person that ever had a problem with me welding was my grandfather.
Okay.
But because of the old
stereotype
and that, and because Well, the methods have improved, and the helmets have improved and everything like that. And yes, there are health factors and stuff like that, but they're not as bad as they used to be.
Well, Leslie, can you share with our listeners? There may be people out there listening who really are wanting to get into this work, whether it's welding, or there may be some woman out there listening who wants to get into a job that is typically considered men's work, and they want to get into a union, but they don't know what the first step is. What are the steps to getting into a union?
Well, actually getting online, to tell the truth, that's how I started, is getting online, mm-hmm. and I'm somewhat new to the Kansas City area. I've only been around roughly about a year.
Okay.
Here in the Kansas City, Missouri area.
Uh-huh.
And what I did was I got online, I started talking to friends of mine that were like in the painters union, the carpenters union, hoisting engineers, which is heavy equipment and that, talking to those guys, and it was like, okay, you need to go here, here, and here.
Well, where should a person go?
Now, like, I can't remember the addresses because, like I said, I'm still new to the area.
But just for you trying to get into a union that would allow welding, what have you done to get in?
Well, first off, got the address, went and showed up on the days that are required, because sometimes they have, like, the first Monday of the month or the last Friday of the month.
And I
that
see.
You go and you fill out the paperwork, you turn it in, or you put it in the mail and mail it to wherever that goes to. And you kind of, like with the iron workers.
Yeah.
Okay, they will give you a list of employers and that you go and check into. And when I checked into that, it was an off season, so nobody was hiring.
Mm-hmm. And then, so let me stop you there and just ask this: you have to fill out paperwork, an application, mm-hmm. and then you go to a job site and see if they will hire you.
Well, like with the iron workers, it's like yes, you do the paperwork, and then if you could get your letter of intent signed by a particular company or foreman.
Oh,
such,
uh-huh.
And then once you get that done, because they are willing to hire you,
yes.
you go back to the hall, you finish doing your paperwork, you pay your first month's dues and that, and that's like for the iron workers. Don't really know how the boiler makers works, but you are on a lottery system.
I see.
And like with the iron workers and the boiler makers, depending on which, where you're at in the United States and that.
Right.
Like if you've been in the military, you're in one classification. If you've been to a trade school, you're in a classification.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've learned like on the job, you're in a different classification. And then that's like a grading people.
Right.
It was like the military guys, they're like first picked.
Uh-huh.
And so on and so forth. And you go through an apprentice program, which takes 3-4 years. To go from an apprentice to a journeyman.
So if you ended up going to a job site and you say, I'm applying to be a welder, would you then, they say, yes, we've got an opening here. Then you go back to the union hall, tell them you've got a potential employer, and then you become an apprentice with the welding union? With that particular union?
With that company and the union, both.
And who, if you're an apprentice, who is going to monitor you?
Actually, your employer. And then also through the unions, they have classes you take, which is also helps you go from an apprentice to a journeyman. You've learned different skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you'll learn, like, MIG, and taking that, and they want to know where you're at in those skills.
I see.
And that, and then like some of it's hands-on and stuff like that. And it's just a progress of going through classes every so many months or so.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Leslie. Do you think this kind of work would be good for a woman? Are there traits that a woman would need to become a welder?
From what I've heard the guys say, quite mm-hmm. literally right out of their mouths are, women make better welders because we're into fine detail. And then, like, if you have an artistic side
mm-hmm.
in a female, you want everything to look nice. And
okay.
then you want everything to hold, you know. be stabilized and everything like that, which is like burning in everything to where it's structurally safe, depending rather it's on an automobile, a tanker, in the oil fields.
So, Leslie, you're glad that you're on this path.
Yes.
And you'd recommend this line of work for women?
I would. I mean, it's not for everyone.
Uh-huh.
But there's, everybody has their own thing that they're geared for, so.
Well, Leslie, I want to thank you for sharing your story tonight with our listeners here at Heartland Labor Forum. I think you're an example of a pioneer woman. You are thinking outside the box. You're not saying if hires who will say, we don't want a woman around here, that you're not going to let that stop you.
No.
And I want to remind our listeners something I've often said. Sometimes the best man for the job is a woman.
Quite correct.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're welcome.
Now you all stay tuned.
Hi folks, RJ here. Join me in celebrating 10 years on the air with a benefit concert on Friday, May 29th at Holy Cow Market and Music, 3107 Gillum Road. Featuring Iron Sunshine, The Wasman, and Fast Johnny Ricker with special guests Paul Grigsby of JPT Scare Band, whose first two albums have just been released on Ripple Music. We'll preview them between sets. It's a night of great local music celebrating and supporting KKFI. Friday, May 29th at Holy Cow Market and Music. More info at kkfi.org/events.
On June 6, 2015, there will be a massive tar sands resistance rally in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thousands will march protesting expansion of toxic tar sands pipelines and oil trains in the heartland, as well as stand for a clean energy future. To learn more, go to tarsandsresistance.org. This is a public service announcement of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good evening, Michael Savoy. During the Washington window with Mark Gruenberg. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, everybody.
Yes, good evening to you. You know, often we find the goings-on in Washington, D.C. amusing, Mark, but it's really not funny, some of the things that are going on. And, you know, I try to encourage my friends and family to... you know, to take this serious, man, because they're seriously impacting our lives. And a good example of that, of course, is the TPP. Can you tell us anything about that?
Right. Well, the TPP is one of the three pending free trade, quote-unquote, pacts, which really have a lot to do more than just with trade, that would go through Congress if Congress passes Fast Track. And that's where we are right now. The Senate passed Fast Track last week after a lot of hoop-de-doo, but the House is still up for grabs. Everything I've been hearing is that the margin is going to be within one or two votes. The president and big business and the radical right and the GOP leadership are putting on big pressure on undecided congressmen, members of Congress, and even those who have decided, they're trying to shift the other way. If they're anti-fast track, they're lobbying hard to switch votes. fast track would allow the TPP, and the TPP is bad for workers. Think of NAFTA. It's been called NAFTA on steroids. I mean, think of all the bad stuff, all the factories that closed, the aircraft plants in Wichita, the factories in Kansas City that closed because of NAFTA, and it would be much, much worse with the TPP.
Yeah, so if we lost,
so that's why we have to stop fast track first.
Absolutely. If we lost a million jobs as a result of NAFTA, then there's a likelihood we could lose 5 million jobs as a result of the Trans-Pacific Agreement.
You were breaking up, and there's an ambulance in the background. I apologize for the ambulance.
Yeah. I recently had a conversation with my congressman locally who really mm-hmm. expressed his displeasure about it. He didn't commit to not voting for it, but my sense is that he won't. But I'm reminded that how we need to stand, and take nothing for granted on this. This is too close for comfort, Mark.
Exactly. We put in our editorial today that even if your congressman has already said, he or she has already said, I'm going to vote against Fast Track, a call doesn't hurt because the member is getting pressure from the other side and needs to know that he or she is standing with us, with workers, in order to resist that pressure. So, if they're pro-fast track, call them and lobby them to turn around. If they're anti-fast track, call them and thank them and say, we hope they continue.
Yeah.
Because fast track is going to be the key to the TPP and to the other two trade pacts that are pending. And let's talk about those other two for a second. One of them is trade and services. This is the type of thing that would allow government services to be exported overseas. My favorite here is the Indiana Toll Road. I'm originally from Illinois. A Republican governor in Indiana sold off the toll road to a bunch of Arabs, in so many words, without fast track, sold off to a group of Arabs. The tolls have doubled. The maintenance has gone down, and what had been well-paying jobs maintaining the toll road have gone out the window. This is the type of thing that the TPP and the trade and services contract would allow. Then there's the third one. That's with Europe. Europe would love to have this. They had their version of the TPP. They'd go after the post office. They'd say, you can't have a monopoly on delivering first-class mail. You should be like us, where much of Europe has privatized their mail service and it has gone down the tubes. So all these things endanger good, well-paying, middle-class, union jobs, union and non-union jobs.
Oh, certainly.
All would go through if Fast Track went through.
Yeah. Well, as I said, Mark, it's amusing, but it's certainly not funny. And, if there was
any... It is not funny at all.
If there was any sincerity with these kinds of issues, there would be no need for Fast Track. Why not have an open discussion about it? Why not just have the people know all we can know about the issue rather than to hide behind closed
doors?
Everything's
been done in secret.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's correct.
Absolutely. So it's appalling, and I would encourage... I actually took the initiative to write President Obama. Now, not that he'll ever get the letter, but nonetheless, I felt better about it by expressing my my just unabashed disgust with this whole thing. Interestingly enough, these Republicans who have fought him tooth and nail on everything he's proposed, now he's standing in solidarity with them, and that's something wrong with that picture.
Exactly.
Man.
There's very something wrong with it. Yes,
absolutely.
He's part of his. He's tried to use this to kowtow to the business community. Even though the business community, along with the Republicans, are the ones who wanted him out ever since. Before he became president. Yeah. Well, One more thing. The way to get a hold of your member of Congress, if you don't have the phone number, there's two ways. One is the Capitol switchboard. 202-224-3121 and ask for the name of your member of Congress. The other is your union, in all likelihood, has a toll-free number that will patch you through to the member of Congress. And even for non-union people, you can call up a local union, find those toll-free numbers, and gave a toll-free call to Washington to say, hey, look, fast track's going to hurt me, in so many words.
Absolutely. Mark, we want to thank you for being on our show tonight, man. We always appreciate your insight and your words of wisdom to our listeners here at KKFI. So thanks a bunch, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay, one more thing.
Okay.
One more thing. Fast Track may come up before the end of the month, so call now, okay?
Okie doke. Thank you, Mark. Good night.
Okay, mm-hmm. Sure, right.
And thank you, Michael and Mark, for that insightful commentary. I tell you, TPP, very bad news. I need to do the calendar. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee is on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut. The 2015 Magic Camp, which is mentoring a girl in construction for high school girls, takes place June 1 through 5th at the Builders Association Training Center at 105 West 12th Avenue in North Kansas City, Missouri, 64116. It is sponsored by the NAWIC, which is the National Association of Women in Construction, and KC Construction Industry. For information on this, call 816-564-3589, or you can find more information at kcnawic.org. Lastly, we've got the Midwest School for Women Workers, which takes place July 19th through the 23rd at DePaul and Roosevelt Universities in Chicago. For a brochure and registration and scholarship information, go to www.midwestwomenworkers.org. And also, if you are a Coalition of Labor Union Women member, they also have a scholarship for you, too. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. You can like us on Facebook, and if you'd like to volunteer for the Heartland Labor Forum, call us at 816-235-1470. That has been tonight's show. Next week on our Heartland Labor Forum, it'll be Matt Kennard on the trail of the global capitalist racketeers and the high public cost of low fast food wages. And I've been your engineer and host tonight, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.